Hey everyone, I'm Ian DeBorja, and welcome to IMDb's Movies That Changed My Life, a podcast where your favorite stars break down the films that made them who they are today. This week's guest is actor and fellow podcaster Justin Long. You may know Justin from his roles in cult classic comedies like Galaxy Quest and Accepted, but you can now listen to him every week on his incredible podcast, Life is Short with Justin Long. Justin and I talk about the pressure of having to answer what your number one favorite movie of all time is, his Marty McFly mannerisms, and the three movies that changed his life. Once again, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to give us a star rating and leave a review because every single one counts. Thanks to Milia X2 for the most recent 5-star review. Thanks again for listening. Here's Movies That Changed My Life with Justin Long. Justin Long, welcome to Movies That Changed My Life. I'm really glad we were able to reschedule you because I know you lost power for a few days after the tropical storm that hit New York a few weeks ago. So how are you doing?
Oh, yeah. You know, we actually just recently, I think, what was that, like 2 weeks ago, right?
Maybe three.
So we only about 5 or 6 days ago got a power back. And it was really... It was so embarrassing because our generator had blown out and we were one of the last houses to get power. And my neighbors were all like, yeah, we have ours back. So we weren't for some reason. And I called the electric company and I was like, you know, it was frustrating enough because the generator that, you know, we pay for maintenance and stuff, that had blown. But obviously that wasn't their fault. And I'm dealing with somebody at the electric company and they were like, we're showing that. This is weird. We're showing that whole grid is lighting up and it should be back to normal. And I was like, well, it's not. And I was like, probably a little snarky, I'm embarrassed about. And and so then they said, well, we'll have somebody call you back. And like, I was like, please do. You know, this is where it's been like over a week now. And so this guy, this really like gruff electrician guy calls back. And he's like, yeah, you said your electricity's out. I was like, yes, it is. It has been. He's like, I'm showing that you're your breaker is malfunctioning because of a blah, 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 blah. And I said, yeah, I don't know what you're saying. And he's like, there's a pause. He goes, turn your breaker on.
Oh, no.
So I went down on the break room in the electrical room. And sure enough, somebody had turned all of the breakers off. And it was just like, and it reminded me so much. You'll appreciate this, IMDb. It reminded me of that moment in The Cable Guy, which is one of my favorite movies. It's hard not to put The Cable Guy, but it reminded me of that moment where he goes back and just goes, ta-da, and turns on the – you know what I'm talking about? He's
like, yeah.
And he goes, what's the cut cord for? He goes, it's for effect. It was so embarrassing. And he's like, I was like, oh, yeah, I just literally turned on a switch. So well, it's back. We're back.
We're back. We're back in business. Yeah. That's great. So did you have to rearrange some interviews for your podcast, Life is Short with Justin Long?
Oh, wow.
And back forward in that?
Thank you. That was really nice. I didn't have to rearrange interviews for my podcast, Life is Short with Justin Long, because I don't know why, actually. It just worked out that we hadn't scheduled any. It was sort of lucky. But this one, of course, I'm glad we were scheduled because I was looking forward to talking to you. I love talking about movies and yeah.
So Life is Short with Justin Long is on Wondery. It's out. It's on Tuesdays, correct?
Tuesdays, and it's on Wondery. It's at Apple, you know, wherever you get podcasts, I guess. Spotify, all the platforms, yeah.
Yeah, and then for people who don't know, it's just, you know, it's you're having long-form conversations just like this with, you know, with people. Do you have any guests you'd like to plug coming up or anything like that?
Who's coming up? Oh, man, my favorite, Jake Johnson. Jake was so fun. So that's coming out next. And then Carrie Brownstein, who I love.
Nice.
Carrie's great. And that's,
yeah.
If this show were about TV shows, I think Portlandia would be one of my top three.
I absolutely love that show. I mean,
what
a show.
I know. Oh, it was so fun talking to her about that too, because especially now with all the like cultural upheaval, just mm-hmm. imagining what that show would do with some of these things and how they, like talking to her about it made me realize why I love that show so much. Just how insightful it was without having to do too much, you know, to shine a light on the absurdity of a lot of our behavior.
Right.
so
I know.
Great.
So good. Well, I'm looking forward to those two episodes then.
Another reason I was excited about this is because on the podcast I've been doing, my favorite question is also one that people it's difficult for me to ask because people often have they kind of have adverse reactions to it. And that is something as simple as what's your favorite movie? Like I like exploring that. And people often get like a range from being offended by it. But I like tiptoe around it. I like ask it very gingerly. And I preface it by saying like, I mean, obviously you don't have one, but you know, in quarantine, maybe you have a comfort movie or I never know how to really address it. So
do you have a most surprising favorite movie pick of your guests on your podcast that you were like, oh, like I didn't expect that.
Oh God, what a good question. Well, I got very excited this is going to sound like self-involved, but when Judy Greer, without thinking, she just said Tootsie, and I freaked out. I was like, yeah, yes. You know, like sometimes there are moments like that where I just really instantly, movies are a thing that I value them so much that like, I feel immediately closer to somebody when they also, you know, when they share a love of a particular movie. And I got so excited by that. But yes, and now I'm forgetting. There have been some that are like, huh. you know, whether it's an obscure movie or just one, the more surprising ones are the ones that are like Jumanji, you know. And But then it becomes interesting, you know, unpacking why, and it usually has to do with like a very personal, like a childhood memory or something, which is fun to explore. And I think some of mine definitely involve that element, like nostalgia and, you know, reminding me of a nice time in my life.
Awesome. So let's get into the movies that changed Justin Long's life. Do you want to start chronologically? We'll go from chronological release date, or do you have
order?
Okay, cool. Sweet. So yeah, let's jump into Tootsie, which you discussed briefly. This is from 1982. It has a 7.4 out of 10 on IMDb with 94,000 ratings. Directed by Sidney Pollack, written by Don McGuire and Larry Gelbart. The screenplay is by Larry Gelbart and Murish Gall, starring Dustin Hoffman, Jessica Lange, Terry Garr, Dabney Coleman, Bill Murray. So tell me about Tootsie. When was the first time you watched it?
Well, Tootsie, I think I discovered later in my life. And it was when I was like really falling in love with Dustin Hoffman. I think I'd already seen, you know, this was in the 90s. And I had already seen like Rain Man and probably even Hook and some of his other, even Straw Dogs, I think. So Tootsie was like when I was... And I was falling in love with the idea of being an actor, and I just loved that culture of like the theater actor who is I was just so into that character and that story, and my relationship with that movie is like changed. Like I said, I watch it at least once a year, and I just find different reasons to marvel at it, and I think that my favorite thing is probably just the script and the direction and how efficient it is, how every camera shot, every word really helps push the story forward. And the music, I love it. Yeah. I love it. I'll rewind moments. There's a moment where just the timing, I mean, the timing between Charles Durning and Dustin Hoffman when he's giving him the ring back, you know, or when Charles Durning is kissing his hand goodnight and he pulls it away and Durning just kisses his own hand. It's like, it's great slap. There are elements of like great Laurel and Hardy slapstick comedy. And then there's incredible romance. So one of the most romantic movies, seeing his yearning for Jessica Lange underneath this like mask of it's just to me, like I said, I think it's like a work of art.
So you grew up in Connecticut, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Was there sort of like a fascination with especially, I guess, as you were deciding you wanted to become an actor, was there some sort of fascination with, like, getting to Manhattan and, like, being able to become, like, an actor, you know, similar to the scene set in Tootsie?
That's interesting you ask, Ian, because my mom was an actress. And, I wonder if that has something to do with it. So my mom, my first experience with New York was through that lens, like the struggling actress going, like, you know, Terry Garr's character going from mm-hmm. one audition to the next and getting really beaten down by the process. That to me was, when I was a kid, the last thing I wanted to do was be an actor.
Was there any sort of like romanticizing that you had? I mean, watching Tootsie, like you're like, I'm going to live in that apartment. No, none of that. Okay.
No, I mean, what it was I think I was able to, and because Dustin Hoffman's so good, I think I saw that movie at a point where I was already wanting to do that. So this is after high school, and I probably had already been on the audition circuit in New York. So I think there was some identifying with his struggle. But I think more than that, it was the, well, it's funny. I mean, I don't want to like gloss over that. It's just fucking the timing of some of those scenes and the way they're played. It's just, it's funny, but it's also, I think incredibly romantic the way he puts this woman on a pedestal and falls for her with this disguise on. And there's something really, and they're obviously both so good. Mm-hmm. It's just such a complete journey, you know, it's such a great like story to follow. I don't think it was, world is exciting in any way.
Right. You know? And I think it's sort of like also romantic, showing people's passion of wanting to become famous and wanting to follow their dreams, or even in Michael Dorsey or Tootsie's case, like he's wanting to put on this
a play that he believes in. There's something about Michael Dorsey that like, you could say he's pretentious. He's like, when he's got that conversation with Sidney Pollack, the agent, he says, no one's going to do it, Michael. That to me is, I think at the heart of the whole movie. Yeah, you're right. It's somebody who has this passion that they can't express properly. And so it's not so much that he wants to be famous even. Being famous is just a means to an end, which is getting to do his art, his craft, you know. And it's, the character is so consistent. I like that at no point does he ever really get caught up in, oh, I'm famous now. If anything, it's like a deterrent that like, oh, this ruse is like getting really deep. And, you know, what am I going to do now? I'm on the cover of magazines and stuff. And what if ever people find out? It just is that I like that it's not. I think if you made that movie now, because fame is such has become such a thing to aspire to and such a commodity unto itself, I think you'd have to, whoever made that movie now would probably lean into that a little bit more. Like, oh, look at me. I'm on, you know, I've got all these followers. but at the time, it's like that character is just really devoted to acting. And it's and I'm sure a lot of it is because I love acting and I kind of understand that brain.
Yeah, I mean, in the climax of the film, right, he, you know, puts his fame of being this up and coming or star at the time on the line to make sure he does what's right, you know, by in that final episode of the sitcom,
I don't want to, not to give anything away. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely not listen to this because it's one of the great reveals in movie history. Like, I don't know how, and I've always thought that, but like, again, since I started having to learn a little bit about editing and not learn, but just becoming more aware of the mechanics of putting a scene together, I started really like marveling at the shot selection and how all of the characters, even like Lynn Thigpen, who plays the producer, you know, the great Lynn Thigpen, who unfortunately has passed away. She just a cutaway to her and she's got the perfect line, perfect reaction. George Gaines, like, they cut away to Bill Murray and he's got Well, what a wacky hospital. You know, that is one wacky hospital. It's like everyone gets their moment. Charles Durning sees it and he's like, oh my God, this woman I'm attracted to. It's so rich. Like every character is so richly involved in that. The stakes are so high for so many people. And if they're not high, they're still entertaining, you know, like even for Bill Murray's character. So it's just when like things have gotten heavy and like you cut to Charles Durning and he's like, oh my, he's having this like crashing realization. And certainly Jessica Lange, this person that I like trusted and is now like has lied to me. And then you cut to somebody like who has less at stake. And it's like, it lets the audience breathe and laugh a little bit. It's just like perfect. It's perfect.
All right. So that was Tootsie. If you haven't seen it, please go watch from 1982. Let's move on to your second pick. This is 1985's Back to the Future. It has 8.5 out of 10 with 1.02 million ratings on IMDb. Directed by Robert Zemeckis, written by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, starring Michael J. Fox, Christopher Lloyd, Leah Thompson, Crispin Glover. The story is about Marty McFly, a 17-year-old student.
It's funny to have to say that.
I know. Yeah. You've talked about this movie before as like being very important to you. But for those who haven't heard it, why don't you dive into that? I know it sparks so many things, like important things in your life.
Yeah, God, you know, it's funny. You know, when somebody says like, how are you doing? Or what's been going on? It's like, oh man, where do I begin? That's what it feels like to be like, well, talk about why is Back to the Future important? It feels like such an open-ended question. But I think I should start with just the impact it had when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and my memory is so bad, but I do have, I remember clearly seeing that movie for the first time at the Fairfield Community Theater. And I was like, I remember the feeling of being so thoroughly entertained. Like there was something exciting about it, that an excitement that I hadn't really experienced from a movie before. And I revered Marty McFly. I just thought he was the coolest. To this day, I think, like, you know, I know some people grew up in, depending on when you grew up in different times, I'm sure there are people who would say, well, Justin Bieber or Marlon Brando or, you know, these guys were cool, the epitome of cool. But to me, Marty McFly is, and I think will probably forever be, the epitome of cool. He was just.
He invented skateboarding.
Skateboarding, the way he skateboarded was so like he wasn't braggy, he wasn't showing off. He was like reluctant. He was like reluctantly saving the day. Leah Thompson was so charming and beautiful, and she was like in love. Hey, forget that it was his mom. That wasn't troubling to me at the time. I didn't really like understand the Oedipal implications
right
at the time, but I just thought it was like so cool. My friends won't watch it with me anymore because it's like I annoy them too much. It's just obnoxious. But like now, you know, again, like having a newfound appreciation for movies, having been in the business of movies for a while, I just – every time I watch it, I marvel at something new. And I remember recently seeing it and like I was amazed by the opening credits, you know, how much information – they get out.
Yes.
How much exposition, that the setup that like is usually done in like, let's face it, kind of a boring it's not the exciting part of most movies. It's not an interesting part. They take care of so much exposition during that crawl, during that tracking shot of
the
house. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. The plutonium is stolen. There's the newspaper. There's a newscast that they're talking about it. You see that he hasn't been there in a long time. You see that he's this wacky inventor that makes these cool things that don't really work. There's so much. So by the time you meet Doc, yeah, he was Michael J. Fox was such an influence on me as a kid. I just held him up so much that I still think like some of his mannerisms and, you know, his cadences. Are you telling me? I mean, there are times where I can like hear, Doc, are you telling me my mom has got the hots for me? you're so thin. You know, like, it's funny that I can hear it if I step out of myself a little bit. He was huge for me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. He is the coolest, probably the coolest movie character of all time. I know it's funny you were talking about, like, you understand now that you've got to, you're working on your current film with your brother, that you understand sort of movies and, like, this, you're listening to it, like, a screenplay and, like, process level. And I've said this before, but I think Back to the Future is, like, one of the most, if not the most efficient screenplay.
Oh, my God.
There is not,
an ounce of fat on that.
There's not an ounce of fat on it. I mean, every minute matters. Every prop matters. Every scene matters. It's just unbelievably clean.
Yes.
And holds up. Like, there's not, you know, a lot of obviously, like, 80s, particularly, I think, 80s movies, you know, you kind of get hit with the nostalgia and you give passes to some sort of, like, goofiness there. But Back to the Future, there is basically none of that, I think.
I'm always curious, like, what friends of mine who have kids, when they show their kids that movie, I'm so always so curious about their reaction, because I just it's hard for me to judge it with my, you know, my brain is it formed a long time ago during it, you know, so to me, I just wonder if I just can't get out of my own way when it comes to, like, acknowledging that, like. Yeah, those are, because I remember sometimes, like, I'd see movies with my dad and he'd be like, oh, it still holds up, you know? And it was like, No, it doesn't. Like, that that version of, like, Lon Chaney's Wolfman or whatever is like, no, it's not as good as the American Werewolf in London. But and now I look at those movies that I thought, like, God, these effects are so good. And, you know, and sometimes they feel a little dated. But I wonder about Back to the Future, like, if that's if people with kids have that experience where the kids are like, boring. I hope not.
I don't think so. No. So before we move on from this, I do want to say, and you kind of talked about the way you described Marty McFly, about sort of his charm as, like, sort of the everyman, but he's still cool. When I saw you pick this, and I know you've talked about it a lot, your character of Justin in Dodgeball, albeit much nerdier than Marty McFly.
Thank you.
There is the same energy, though, of the way his charisma develops over Dodgeball, obviously until the end of the final, in the playoffs or in the championship. Uh-huh. There is, like, I feel like a similarity there. And then now that you said you sort of pick up on the Marty McFly-isms in your own self, I see that now in Justin a little
that
bit.
That might be one of the nicest things anyone ever said. Well, you know where I see it a lot is the movie Accepted.
Mm, because
because you just have to, you know, you steal from the best. And to me, there's no better leading man than Michael J. Fox. And I watched so much of his work that I just, I'm sure it snuck in there, and he, I mean, always he'll be, you know, he'll be my hero to me.
Yeah, well deserved. Yeah. Character and person, I think, to be on that mantle for you.
I worked with him briefly, and it was such a thrill. And I waited till the last day I was shooting with him to, like, really gush. And I'm sure it snuck out a little bit. I'm sure I didn't play it that cool, but.
You're wearing, like, a Back to the Future shirt the first day of the
shoot. Oh, weird. It's not a vest. It's not a life preserver. And I like doing that. I did that with Christopher Lloyd, too. I really annoyed him. He did an episode of a TV show I was on, and I didn't play it as cool with Christopher Lloyd. And I just remember at one point him getting frustrated and going, I don't remember what the line was. Gigawatt, or I don't remember the line. Because I was just, like, peppering him with... But part of me playing it cool with Michael J. Fox is I didn't want him to sign a Back to the Future poster, because I feel like everyone probably asked him to do that. So I got a Secret of My Success poster, which I also love. He signed that, and it was such, I was so, like, giddy when he was like, oh, you know, no one, yeah, you don't usually sign these, you know. I was like, yes, he thinks I'm cool.
He'll remember forever Justin
this
Long
would be
had
a big
him
big moment for him.
Well, before we move on, as you brought that up, I mean, you worked with Leah Thompson too. You literally play her son.
Yeah.
You know, in literally right before Aaron. So, I mean, you've had her on your podcast also, but was there some sort of like getting over the hump of like, holy crap, I'm like kind of Marty McFly right now?
It was, I had to just tell her. Leah's so cool that I was like, I have to, in case it comes out in a weird, nerdy way that like, I need her to know. I can't like work with this person and not have them know what a huge part of my like childhood they were. And it wasn't flattery, but I felt very self-conscious about somebody as young and beautiful as Leah playing my mom. It felt like I kept referencing it. I kept saying it, hopefully in a non-creepy way, but I was like, this is weird casting to me. And it made me self-conscious about, you know, whatever. And she was really sweet about it and seemed like really happy to be there and very professional, all that. But I even roped her in on the podcast. I roped her into doing a scene. I just like out of the blue was like, under your chair, you'll see a scene from when Marty wakes up in Lorraine's bedroom. And I thought maybe we could do it. I'll tell you, there's no cool way, unless you're Marty McFly, to transition into that asking Leah. I remember like playing Monday morning quarterback on that one and being like, would there have been a more like a smoother way to bring that up?
And folks who are listening to this, if you ever run into Justin on the street, I think you're giving them free right to come up and gush about any scene they want with you, right?
yeah if anything I've done is in any way comparable to, it's hard for me to believe, but of course I'd be flattered.
I mean Galaxy Quest is a massively important movie to so
Galaxy
many people
Quest,
right? Like
really, yeah, that's I that would have luck. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I've heard very people have said very nice things about that, very nice. Yeah, and that to me is like, it's funny because like I don't have, whenever people compliment that movie, I have so little sense of ownership over it. To me it was like, oh my God, what an incredible experience, obviously. And this unique, I flew to LA. When I think of that movie, I think of like flying across the country and staying in a hotel for the first, you know, things like that, like more like coming of age stuff and becoming friends with Sam and Alan Rickman and like meeting these people. But I have no sense of, in other words, like I don't take on a compliment about Galaxy Quest. I don't take that on board at all. Like to me, I was like very lucky to be a piece of that that movie. To me, it's like, oh no, I should be the one. You know, I should be thanking you or anyone for watching it, and I'm just grateful to be in it.
You also tease Lady of the Manor, which is an upcoming film that you are directing. It's on IMDb right now as an upcoming film and. With Melanie
See, that's
Linsky.
Cool. That's how much I like IMDb. That's just like, that just provokes the movie nerd in me. That's cool that it's already on IMDb.
Yeah, it's on there.
The best part is Melanie Linsky and Judy Greer are the leads. And we got so, I mean, like I'm going to get emotional like talking about their performances. They're so good. And when you work so hard on something and you kind of like give it over to somebody else, it's like part of it is just, you know, releasing some control over it, or all control, really, and giving it to the actors. I never really had that experience. I never knew what that was like. And it was, it's very, you feel like very vulnerable. The stakes are so high. And so I just am so, I'll be forever grateful to those two actresses whom I always really admired. I always liked them. I had worked with, well, both of them really, but what they did with these characters was just like something that my brother and I weren't expecting, they elevated it to a very, and they're going to make us look good, you know, because they were just really beautiful performances. But we're excited about it. It's low budget. It's $1 million movie, so you know there are certain we had some restrictions, and but we're happy with it and proud of it and excited.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Lady of the Manor, folks want to follow it on IMDb so they can keep tabs as to when it's going to come up. Well, let's go to the last pick of yours. This is 1987's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It is a 7.6 out of 10 with 118,000 reviews on IMDb, written and directed by the legendary John Hughes, starring Steve Martin and John Candy. The plot is a man must struggle to travel home for Thanksgiving with a lovable oaf of a shower curtain ring salesman as his only companion. Talked about this a little bit, about how you watch this, like a Thanksgiving family watch. Yeah. When was the first time you watched this? Was it with your family? Like, well, was that always from the start of it?
I think so, because it was whenever they started letting us watch R-rated movies, because that movie's rated R. So watching it with them was like, I'm sure that was it, when I first saw it, that was part of like what was exciting about it.
And sure, yeah,
just
yeah.
Getting to, wow, there's cursing and you know, there's that.
Was it like right then and there you were like, this is the greatest comedy I've ever seen in my life?
No, not at all. Okay. In fact, back then it was, you know, this was, it would have been around the time it came out. So let's see, what was I into? I mean, besides Michael J. Fox movies, I was still watching, you know, I was watching Looney Tunes. I was really into Laurel and Hardy, Monty Python, movies like that. So I thought it was funny, but I don't remember thinking, oh, this is the greatest. Like you know, to me, a Laurel and Hardy movie was still funnier. I don't think I'd like cultivated like a real sense of, I just think I was too young for it too. I mean, a lot of that stuff is like, I think in order to
you have
relate,
to kind of experience these adult situations a little bit.
I think so.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
think so. It's hard for me to remember, but.
When did it become that like movie for you then? Was it just over time you kind of realized like, holy, you know, Trains, Automobiles,
And it got to the point, Ian, where like I would be watching it and I found myself getting like really emotional. You know, I realized I was experiencing it on a much different, adult levels where I was I was really involved with John Candy's storyline, and it was it became funnier to me over the years. It became more relatable.
Right.
But like, so Del Griffith, I mean, like,
yes, Del Griffith
doesn't get better than that.
Played by the great John Candy.
Oh God, who, you know, I think about like, I'm not a big like awards guy or like who's going to win the awards this year. I don't even know why I bring this up, but I think about it a lot when I think about John Candy in that movie, which is like, I think it's crazy that he didn't win an Oscar for that, for that movie. That actually to me sums up why I guess I don't put much stock in awards, because you can have a performance like that, you know, like John Candy in that movie is that to me, it's up there with the Daniel Day-Lewis. It's up there with one the greatest performances in movies and funny, yeah. But like, it's the heart that he
so much heart. It's so man. It's so pure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, he's such an innocent. He's such a, which is why whenever I hear stories about John Candy, where like people talk about how what a sweet, like just a good person he was, you know, I've heard stories about him that are just like, oh, he spent time with me. And he was a giving by all accounts, like a generous person. I'm never surprised, because that, I don't know if you can be anything else and give a performance like that. To me, that to me is just pure heart on screen. Like there's the compassion and the sense of pain and the kindness that he is able to project. It's some of the most moving acting, and the combination of with John Hughes' direction and the score, that kind of like synth.
Yeah, I wrote down John Hughes' scores are always great.
Oh God, they pair so beautifully with those scene that scene and Steve Martin opening the door, Dal, come on inside, you know, and he invites him mm-hmm. in, and then it cuts to them on the bed drinking those little bottles, and it's warm, and it's just pure friendship between them, and they're drunk, and they're just like talking about the women from their past, and they're laughing with each other, and it's like. It doesn't get better than that. It's always like just riding that fine, fine line between profound and moving and then schmaltzy and like over the, mm-hmm. manipulative. Mm-hmm. And it's manipulative, just, yeah. and to ride that line the way John Hughes does is like, I know I keep saying this, but to me, that's a work of art. That's like a work of genius.
You know, I always think it's just, since we're on John Candy, I mean, when I was watching this, I just was thinking, like, imagine if he, you know, if he was still around, if we,
the
comedy world and the film world were like blessed enough to still have him here. Yeah. I mean, I get like chills thinking about what he could have done as an elder statesman in comedy, you know, whether it's getting involved with like the Ferrell and Vince Vaughn and the, crew, or even now with like, the modern takes, like even like the Broad City things. Like I could see his humor and like popping up as influence and being like a part of like continuing to raise the bar and support like young comedians. It's so sad to think about.
I don't deify John Candy or like I don't revere him the way I do because he like left too early. I've gone through a relationship with him and that movie since the time I saw it, like those other two movies, maybe even more so because that movie to me is about, we watch it every Thanksgiving. And so it has such great, familial connotations and like it's a lot of great family nostalgia and reminds me of that being together. But it also, I'm continuously like moved by the message of this guy needing some people not having that and how important that is to convey to people especially like privileged people like myself. It is just such a beautiful story and relationship between the two of them. And like I said, I love Odd Couple comedies, and you can't have John Candy can't do what he does in that without Steve Martin,
who playing the perfect grump,
right? and
frustrated guy,
and like the last time I saw it, I was like and you can commiserate with him. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not as
totally
though,
he's trying to get home.
He's trying to get home. His kids, there's such a warm environment that's waiting for him, and he's being, and John Candy then, that's the other brilliant thing. It's like, he does do these really annoying things. It's like, he takes his socks off and wafts them around in front of Martin, and like, he does genuinely things that, people who travel can relate to as being annoying. And he's like a little, he wants to chat when like, you get on a plane and all you want to do is just like, oh, dude. And he's like, so what? So I love the way, one of my favorite moments is when he goes, Steve Martin clearly doesn't want to talk. And he's not being overtly rude. He's just like giving the social signals that like, one word answers and like polite, but not friendly. And John Candy is like, a bowl in a china. He's not picking up any of them, and he just goes. There's like kind of a lull in the conversation. It's clear Steve Martin's like in his own world. John Candy just goes, Del Griffith, and John Candy or Steve Martin shakes his hand. And he goes, and you are. It's like that to me sums up the brilliance of that, and he like. Because then Steve Martin has to say, Neil Page.
He's cornered him at that point.
He's cornered him. And like, and John Candy, once he gets the name, he goes, watch it again. He goes, Neil Page, pleased to meet you, Neil Page. And it's this, it's such a perfect example of on what different pages they're both on. It's like, there are no jokes. It's not like. You watch Odd Couple comedies now, and it's like it's filled with jokes and like, and this is just John Hughes is so confident in the, I guess how they're his actors, but also the relatability of that situation. And it's subtle, but it's so clear that Steve Martin just wants to put on his headphones if he had them, just wants to read his thing, and John Candy wants a friend. And the combination of that, them wanting such different things is – he gets so much comedy out of that. And then later he gets like – humanity out of it.
Right.
Like an exploration of
the montage when they finally separate ways and Steve Martin gets home on his train, and the montage when he realizes that John Candy his Del Griffith's wife is actually dead. It starts off like so goofy, and then he goes back and he realizes all like little senses, and like the payoff there is so good. You know, they don't draw out them being like a pair for like over half the movie or even the last act of the movie. It's literally the last 5-10 minutes.
I wish you could see me. I wish this were filmed because I'm getting chills. My hair is standing up because it's so good. It's so masterfully done. And you're right. It goes from like, he's like, oh yay, I'm going home, and like talks about his family. And goofy thoughts about, you're right. It goes from like, oh, I remember when we woke up in bed together, and like goofy things and silly things. And then I forget what it is that like kind of like triggers a moment in Steve Martin where
John Candy says, I haven't been home in years.
Like seriously? And he goes, no, it's a figure of speech. And he catches himself. Oh man.
So
oh
good.
Man. I think I can watch that so many times because I get something different every time. There's something I discover every time. I just marvel.
Is there something like as a comedian or as someone who works in comedy films, like, is there something you learned from these three movies that you think that stick out to you? Do you think that has influenced you?
I've talked to a bunch of actors. I was just talking to Joel McHale about this, about, he had that experience on Community, which is there was so much dialogue to get out. And oftentimes dialogue that is not all that naturalistic, like not necessarily the way people talk. And we were talking about how it took us a while to understand that a lot of it is just speed. I know to reduce it to that is like probably really like insulting to a lot of actors, but I had this revelation where it's like, oh yeah, you want to like get through, it's timing and it's speed. And if all of those movies, Tootsie and Back to the Future, Planes, Trains, as much as I love improvising, what those actors do in that is they really respect the script and the story. And I think if I did learn anything from that eventually, it's that it's to really respect the script and the timing. Mm-hmm. And some of my favorite moments of those movies are just the back and forths and the timing. And it's so few of them are indulgent, you know, and all of those movies have that in common. They were also brilliant scripts, you know.
Well, Justin, this was an awesome conversation. Oh, I'm glad we got to. It's great.
It's so fun. Yeah, thanks, Ian.
And folks, for listening, don't forget to check out Life is Short with Justin Long. It's on Wondery or Apple Podcasts or Google or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And Justin, we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to head over to imdb.com/podcasts for more content on Justin and to easily add the movies that changed his life to your IMDb watch list.